Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Business Book. I'm your host, Derek Lewis, and today I have CEO of Greenleaf Book Group, Tanya Hall. So Tanya is the CEO, as I said, of this Austin-based publisher that has been pioneering the hybrid model of publishing that has arisen to kind of, I guess, bridge the gap between traditional publishing and then vanity press or self-publishing, as it used to be known. But before coming on to Greenleaf, she developed a number of successful publishing strategies that led to some best-selling New York Times books, as well as pioneering a digital imprint program with Greenleaf. And then before coming over to publishing, she was actually a TV producer with Extra and E Cable Networks. So welcome, Tanya, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
That's quite a journey to go from TV production to publishing, and then from publishing to being CEO of a hybrid publisher. So how did that journey go, and what has being a TV producer taught you about publishing?
So, yeah, I've been told I did it backwards. And usually people go from publishing into television, but hey, I'm just the non-traditionalist in me. So, yeah, I grew up actually in Los Angeles. I was a film major, so I caught that bug early, went to film school, and worked in television straight out of college. I was very lucky to get a break over at Extra when that show was still fairly young. And in a case of worlds colliding, I guess, by the time I moved over to E Cable Networks, I was the person handling books amongst other beats. And that was largely because I was the young rookie and nobody wanted to deal with the books because it was a celebrity news network and most often the stuff we were being pitched was not celebrity oriented. So that actually, fortuitous, I guess, it all worked out in the end. But I would say the thing that I learned from television that carried over into publishing is that, frankly, it's all media. And whether it's TV or books or film, we all really have the same sort of core challenges, which is oversupply and under demand, right? So in television, we talk about eyes on screens, and in film, it's butts in seats, and in publishing, so we're all kind of vying for these eyeballs that, of course, are being pulled in a million directions by all kinds of competing media platforms. And so we have to continually kind of make sure that people are raising the bar content-wise and also, of course, with our platform and marketing. So the thing, of course, in media is that there are some core challenges across all platforms, whether it's publishing, film, or television. So in television, we used to talk about eyeballs on screens. In film, it's butts in seats. And in publishing, it's getting books off of shelves. And all of that to say that we're dealing with an issue of an oversupply of media product and under demand simply because our audience is being pulled in a million different directions and more so every day as they're reading blogs and playing new virtual reality apps and all these other things that are taking up their free time or the time they would be reading, as we were hoping in this current business. So that is definitely the common thread that's been pulled through my career and really just the impetus for my drive at this company to make sure that our content is rock solid and very compelling and actionable and creating value for the reader, and certainly our drive to help our authors develop strong platforms and really hone the approach they take to market their books and reach those appropriate audiences.
Tanya, you know, I've in introducing you and in the first couple of minutes here, I've referred to Greenleaf a couple of times as a hybrid publisher. So for one, is that how you would describe what y'all are doing at Greenleaf? And two, am I even introducing you right?
Thanks for asking. Yes, that is how I've been describing Greenleaf for a long time. And usually I'd have to caveat it because an eyebrow would go up and people, what does that even mean, a hybrid model? And we were one of the first. This company's been around since 1997 with that model from the beginning. How I explain it to folks is our model really is, as you said at the beginning of the show, in between self-publishing and traditional publishing, in that we're taking the strengths of self-publishing and those of traditional publishing and combining them while eliminating the downfalls of each. So from the self-publishing side, we bring creative control, we bring speed to market, we bring a larger share of royalties because our authors are investing in the production of their books, and the ownership, which is, of course, critically important these days for more and more of our authors who are also speakers or using this content in some other way to support their brand. And then from the traditional side, and this is where we're very different from a lot of other people who call themselves hybrid publishers, from the traditional side, our company operates like a traditional publishing house in that we handle distribution in-house. We are a master distributor, and that is the roots of the company. We distribute internationally and have a field force of sales reps and call on the airport accounts and negotiate co-op placements and all of that good stuff. So we have the distribution muscle that usually a self-publishing author lacks because they're just the one person with the one title. And so that's obviously what brings the visibility and gets the book out into the marketplace. And to support that, we have to maintain a very high level of quality. So we're very particular about what we bring on. There's a complete vetting process on the front end, and we do about 120 books a year, which might sound like a lot, but it's less than 10% of what we see come through the doors.
So, Tanya, let's assume that that we've got a couple of people listening who really don't understand the difference between traditional and self-publishing to begin with, much less that sweet spot of being a hybrid. So could you give maybe a couple of examples of how going with the hybrid, so you listed what the disadvantages were versus a traditional publisher or self-publisher, but could you give maybe a story or a real-life scenario of how the hybrid model that Greenleaf has pioneered eliminates some of the disadvantages of going with one or the other?
Oh, sure. And, of course, there are a number of different cases in which we might be an appropriate choice and other cases in which we're not. And I've always been an advocate of the mindset that there's plenty of room in this industry for all kinds of different business models, and there's no right or wrong. There might be a few wrong ways, but really there's no right or wrong way. We can talk about those in another show.
Yeah.
So it's really, it is a matter of choice and of priorities and goals. But let's see, an example would be, so quite often our authors are speakers and consultants and people who, as I said earlier, have the book serving a greater purpose in terms of driving their visibility, and often I'm really kind of sick of hearing a book being called a glorified business card because it's so much more than that. But
yeah.
It is to a degree, okay? It's a marketing piece, and it's a tool that people use to create word of mouth. And so folks like speakers and consultants who have what we call a large direct sales platform, meaning in theory they could directly invoice a sale for an audience and a speaking engagement and so forth, often those people will do better in a model that's either self-publishing or one like ours that's hybrid, where they're investing on the front end because then they own the books. And when you own the books, you're essentially paying production costs, and then when you sell them back of room, of course, the money that you make in the delta there is yours to pocket. Versus in a traditional model, a lot of people don't understand this in the beginning, you actually have to buy your books back from the publisher because they're fronting all of those initial costs. So I love speaking with business authors because they get it when I say that it's very much like comparing bootstrapping a business to venture capital. And our model is bootstrapping. So bootstrapping, of course, you're putting money in on the front end, but that's because you recognize that there's likelihood that the math is going to favor you on the back end when you're keeping a bigger piece of those per unit sales or royalty. Of course, venture capital is playing with other people's money, and there's less risk in terms of what you have to invest on the front end, and that would be the traditional model, of course, because you'd be getting in advance. But the royalty on the back end is much leaner, if anything at all, ultimately. And you give up some creative control, and that's another example of, actually I haven't given you an example yet, so back up and give you an example of one author who kind of bounced between some different models, which is interesting. Mary Lou Quinlan is just a dear friend of mine in addition to being one of our authors. And she's a New Yorker, and she runs a very successful market research company called Just Ask a Woman. And they do, as you might guess, market research oriented around female consumers, and they serve, you know, big Fortune 100 clients. So she had done a number of books traditionally. I believe she was a Random House author and maybe did one with Simon & Schuster. Then came to us with a business book called What She's Not Telling You. And before she ran Just Ask a Woman, Mary Lou actually had a design firm. So she had some very strong ideas about how this book should look and its format. She wanted it to be something kind of small and playful and very designy, not like your standard business book. And as you might imagine, like, that was going to be a tough sell in a traditional market where you're probably more likely to have your traditional publisher say, we're going to take control of how the book looks, you know, to the reader, because we know what's best. So Mary Lou decided she wanted to have that creative control, came to us to do What She's Not Telling You, and she did, in fact, end up with this really interesting-looking business book that's full of great stories but also is visually compelling all the way through, because she knew that that was a book she wanted to use primarily in her speaking, and for her, the retail sales were gravy, and they were helping to drive her awareness. We did have her in the bookstores and in airports, but she really wanted that book to have for her back-of-room speaking sales. And then, as it turns out, a few years later, she did a book with us completely unrelated to the business side of things called The God Box, which was about her mother's passing and very, very interesting and heartfelt lessons that she learned just about letting go. And the woman is just a one-woman marketing machine. She's absolutely amazing. She put so much gusto behind that launch because it was really coming from the heart. And she switched genres, right? She went from business over to what was, you know, borderline, I would say it was almost a religious book. It's really inspirational. So often a traditional publisher will kind of look unfavorably at an author jumping between genres because they think that they're going to be alienating their core audience or moving away from where their sales actually might be. So that was something that Mary Lou recognized, and she said, not only do I want to have, again, the creative control in this book, she certainly knew how she wanted it to look and how she wanted to honor her mother through its publication, but she also needed to get it out in a hurry, and which came to us in November, and we crashed this book, as we would say in TV, and had it out by Mother's Day. But she also knew that on the traditional side of things, it wasn't going to get done that fast, and they weren't going to let her, or they wouldn't look favorably on her publishing in a genre that she had never even dipped a toe in before. So it was kind of a risk, and a risk that she was confident about taking, and she was right, because like I said, it became a New York Times bestseller in its second week of release, so that was definitely a great story for us to tell.
Wow. You know, whenever I came to the Greenlee's office earlier this year, I remember seeing the God Box on the shelves there, where you have all of your author's books displayed. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you. Yes, I love talking about that book because it's a little different one for us. I mean, so many of our New York Times bestsellers are business books, and that's great. That's definitely our sweet spot. So this one was, we all understood, I guess, the power behind her wanting to honor her mother. She was an only child, and if you have a chance to read it or gift it to your own mother, it's this most beautiful book. And so the fact that it was so intimate to her and that we were a part of it, first of all, was an honor to be able to help her bring it to the world. And I will tell you with full honesty and absolutely one of my top three moments ever in my life, calling Mary Lou while she was sitting in a restaurant having lunch and telling her she made the New York Times bestsellers list, and her freaking out in the middle of this restaurant and the people all around her starting to clap. We were both crying. I just
Oh.
love it. It's such a great story.
Wow, that is great news to be able to call and tell someone.
That's the best.
I want to talk about that here in a second, because so many people, aspire to be a New York Times bestseller. But before we get to that, I wanted to say that I'm with you, Tanya, whenever you say that there's not one right way to publish. Sometimes whenever I'm talking to authors, I'll push them towards the traditional model, or I'll push them towards the hybrid model, or depending on what they're doing, I'll push them towards the self-publishing model. So the questions that I'm about to say, it's I'm not trying to. I don't have an agenda. I'm really just in a little bit of maybe a little bit of devil's advocate, but mostly just to help people get a better idea of how these three different routes function. So let's say that Mary Lou decided to go not the hybrid route, but decided to go the self-publishing route. What would it have been like for her not having Greenleaf support, just going at it alone, basically being her own micro publisher?
And when you self-publish, I think that's one of the major differences is you become kind of the general contractor, right? So you're the one who's marshaling all the different resources, the indexer and the designer and the editors and so forth. So that in and of itself is one thing to consider. Do you have the time and the skills, frankly? Not everyone is good at that to take on that role. So for Mary Lou, being someone who's running a company on top of, doing this passion project, she valued, of course, just the one point of contact and the team of support that she would get by working with someone like Greenleaf. So that's one difference. Quality is the other thing, because although most people have a vision for their book, most of us are not designers and or editors, and so there's a reason those people have that very specific role in this business. They're great at what they do. You can still, of course, as a self-publisher, farm that out. It can be difficult to understand really what looks good and what doesn't to the retail buyer's eye, which is super important when you work in a vacuum and you don't have that contact with the retail buyers. So that's another advantage to, even if it's not through a hybrid publisher, to maybe have a consultant or someone on your side who can speak to what works in retail and what the retail buyers are going to react to versus just what looks good to you and your designer. There's different looks for different genres, and I've seen many cases of a design that's okay, but had they paid a little more attention to fonts and so forth, it would have had a much stronger chance of being viable in a bookstore. And then, of course, the major difference is distribution. So if she had self-published, that book would probably have been available on Amazon and, the online retailers, but had little physical presence. And I think there's a little bit of a dangerous misconception about the current state of brick and mortar, because a lot of people will say, well, Amazon's all that matters, right? No. We actually, more than half of our book sales are in brick and mortar channels. And I think for most publishers, it's probably closer to a 40-60 relationship, with 40% of that being Amazon. So they're a huge player, yes. A lot of eggs sit in that basket, but not all of them. And that's an important distinction between self-publishing and traditional publishing, because for a lot of books, there's a lot more potential than just selling online.
Well, and even Amazon themselves are opening they're opening
Yes,
a
full
physical
circle.
store. And one thing that you said in there, Tanya, about quality, I've found that authors often just through sheer I hate to use the word ignorance because that sounds degrading, but just through sheer inexperience, even if they hire a professional graphic designer, they A may not realize that that graphic design is one thing, but then graphic design for the cover of a book And even if you have somebody who is who designs book covers, to have someone who designs a cover that's suitable for your genre. So cookbooks have a very distinct look. Fantasy books, very distinct look. Thrillers, very distinct look. And business books, a very distinct look. And even some plenty of cover designers are used to working in fiction. Don't realize that there's even genre-specific elements that have to go on. So one of the things that I find whenever an author works with a professional is just getting access to the vetted professionals that that professional or consultant or company has. So I'm sure that that's one thing that plenty of your clients don't even realize that Greenleaf is bringing to the table.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that's an excellent point, and one that's kind of hard to make sometimes because we're talking about visuals. And one of the things that comes up here on occasion is people, in addition to being a publisher, as I mentioned earlier, we are a distributor at the core of the business, and we still bring on a number of books each year that are already produced, and if they're produced to a strong level of quality, then we can just drop them into our sales system and title to the trade. So it's a distribution relationship. And a lot of people will approach us for that and unfortunately do not have a good cover. And we'll go back to them and say, this is why we're rejecting it. And they say, well, what can I do to improve the cover? And the answer is get a new one. But, you know, they sometimes they really want to, like, well, is it the font? Is it this? Is it that? And especially
yeah.
for someone like me and most of my non-design team, it's very difficult to speak in words around a visual concept. And sometimes you just have to show them the power of a before and after. So we have this whole drawer of before and afters that we've done here where I can sit down with somebody and say, here's how this book came in. And again, these are people who don't work in publishing. I don't expect them to understand that a flat gloss lamination is really not good. Those are things that we dork out over. They shouldn't have to think about that. But I'll show them, here's the before, here's the after. Oh, here's another before, here's the after. And then pointing out
yeah,
the distinctions.
Yeah, picture's worth a thousand words.
Absolutely. And after we've done that five or six times, they say, okay, I get it. You have to see it sometimes. But, yeah, there's just these designers, that's what they live and breathe. And so they study the trends. They study what's selling. They buy the samples of what's moving in that category, and of course, you know, having the relationships with those buyers on the distribution side, we get their direct feedback to say, sometimes it's an individual's preference. For a long time at Borders, back when that was still a player, there was a children's book buyer who hated white covers. So you have to take that into consideration, you know? Okay, well, if we have a children's book, we know that this woman hates white covers, so don't go that way.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That's the fun stuff.
Wow. Well, all I can say to that is you don't have to worry about that anymore.
That's very true, unless she's landed at Barnes & Noble or something. I don't think she has.
Well, I've got a couple of kids, and I was just in the children's section the other day, so I saw white covers, so apparently if she was there, she's not high enough to affect it yet.
Good, yeah. Well, she's probably been cut along with most of the bookshelves in that section to make room for toys.
Yeah, that's something that that Barnes & Noble has been doing. I don't get into books a million much, but Barnes & Noble's been doing that. I really think a lot of indie bookstores are missing out on, is that they're transforming themselves from just a bookstore to a retail store that sells books, but they also sell plenty of other, I don't know if you want to call it lifestyle products, but I mean everything from music and movies to educational toys. They have they're selling Legos, they're selling Pokemon action figures. I mean, it's almost
entertainment store, really, information and entertainment.
Yeah.
It was fascinating. I mean, it's the transformation is still happening. I'm surprised more people don't talk about it, but I think it's very interesting to watch and to see how these stores are allocating their floor space.
mean, I know that bookstores for so long have been primarily about volume. I mean, like any other retail store, how much money can you get per square foot? How much inventory can you get per square foot of store space? But I think that a lot of the indie booksellers, I don't think that they realized that one of the advantages that they had, and I guess the remaining ones have, over Amazon, over online, is that you can't deliver a real-life experience online. Mm-hmm. So instead of trying to compete with volume and price, which is impossible whenever you have a digital platform like Amazon, is instead focus on impulse buys, focus on more entertainment things that are more more lucrative per purchase, but going with live events, doing more community buy-in, having more community events and readings and local authors and even hosting authors. I mean, Barnes & Noble don't have nearly as many author events or book store events as they could have, and I think that's one place that indie bookstores could really take on not only the retail giants, but even take on the online giants.
Yes, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said experience, and they definitely have an opportunity to be curating an experience. And I think some of them do that well, and there are some shops that are very kind of niche-oriented who almost do that well by default, like the mystery bookstores, for example, or travel bookstores.
Right.
But I think that curating goes a long way, again, towards getting every dollar out of the pocket of the person that you do get in the door.
but, you know, I don't know. I got off chasing a rabbit trail. I wanted to come back, Tanya, to something that you have had experience with before Greenleaf and then at Greenleaf. One of the biggest questions that plenty of prospects calling me, they want to know, how did they become a New York Times bestseller? And I could go on with what little bit that I know, but really, can I just dump that question in your lap?
Sure. How do you become a New York Times bestseller? Well, number one, I would say you need to have great content. That's a given. You have plenty of folks who will orchestrate campaigns. This is a more involved strategy, but a lot of folks will use their pre-sale orders, as we call them, that are derived from speaking engagements with corporate clients and so forth, to accumulate some momentum in the first few weeks that can help them hit a list. And they do that because, of course, hitting the list is not only bragging rights, but once they can say that they're a New York Times bestseller, their speaking fee goes up by quite a bit. So it's a validation, really, to have that that phrase following your name. So there's no magic bullet, or everybody would hit the New York Times bestsellers list, but it's a combination of things, really. It's highly strategic, and it does take a lot of involvement from the publisher side because, as I said, there's timing involved because those lists are all based around velocity of sales. You know, you can look at a book like What to Expect When You're Expecting, which sells a gazillion copies every week, but never enough at one time to hit a list. It's been out forever, and if we looked at cumulative copies sold, it would probably be in our top 10, but it's all about having them hit in a really kind of condensed window of a week or two. So it's strategic on that end, and how are you going to drum up those orders? But that's not enough, and you also have to have wide distribution. So the book has to be present in a number of bookstores across the country and not just in one little corner. And on top of that, there has to be a strong media push that's going to drive the organic demand. We're hearing about it on the radio or television interviews and print ads and all this other stuff. So it's a big undertaking. I wish there was like a two-minute answer I could give you. Everybody could run off and go hit the bestsellers list and be happy. But as I said, there are folks who spend years really kind of plotting out, here's the approach, here's what we're going to do during this time, here's how we're going to build our marketing list, here's how we're going to create our incentive for pre-orders. So you'll see this quite often where if you buy, even Seth Godin does this, you know, you buy 10 books, you get a copy of my last book signed directly to you. You buy 1,000 and I'll come speak to your organization, you know, that kind of a thing. Those campaigns are very effective in driving those initial pre-sale kind of guaranteed orders that you can then run through retail in an effort to try and really rack up as many of those sales in the first few weeks as possible. But again, you can't just do that. You really have to couple that with your promotional efforts and some good publicity, which is harder, of course, to time precisely. You're really at the whims of whenever the media channel wants to run it. But, you know, it's a little bit of magic and a little bit of science. And a lot of hard work.
Yeah, it sounds like it's quite a bit. I remember reading an article a few years ago about how the New York Times, the people that had done the compiled the bestsellers list, that they had, for a time, people had figured out how to game the list. So they would buy, you know, 10 or 20,000 or whatever copies of their own book and basically pull a couple of shenanigans so that they could be called a New York Times bestseller and make the list. Then the people at the New York Times, they redid their algorithm, and now it's almost as top secret as Google search algorithm. But the basics of it remain that it's based on a survey. So they do a survey every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not total number of sales. It's just however many people or however many stores, whenever they conduct that survey, happen to be reading or have that book in stock, right? That's the crux of it.
Right. And it, again, it has to be a book that where they're seeing the answer to that survey is spread out across the country. And you're right. What you said is absolutely correct, that there were some folks manipulating that list. I think very famously, L. Ron Hubbard and, you know, the at my house now, the Scientology folks would, you know, they would buy thousands of copies of Dianetics and sell it back to the organization and just keep buying their own books to raise the profile of the book and keep it on that list, trying to recruit more people into the religion. So they were one of the first ones to do that. And yes, the Times is very sensitive to that, and they'll flag things. They'll flag books for bulk sales. They'll flag books. We've learned that a second edition is not eligible to hit the list, which I didn't know previously, but learned that the hard way. If you have a book that's been out before and you reissue it in an effort to hit the list, it's not going to happen. That's one of their rules. So you're right. They have a lot of rules that are not disclosed, and all of them are, and they shouldn't be, frankly. So all of those exist to try to maintain, you know, the integrity of that list.
You know, I always caution my authors whenever they start talking about wanting to hit the New York Times list. One, because it's not a guarantee that their book is going to be literally a best-selling book. It just so happens that it hits that list. If I had to choose between either hitting the New York Times or having a book that had good enough content, strong enough platform underneath it, good enough promotion behind it, that it continually sold copies, such as, you used a great example, What to Expect If You're Expecting. Everybody knows that book. That book has sold God only knows how many copies. But like you said, it never hit a bestseller list. If I had to choose between hitting the New York Times bestseller or having a book that steadily sold copy after copy after copy, I would go with What to Expect When You're Expecting.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think that most of the folks who are writing business books, given that generally they are hoping the book will drive long-term business, I think in their heart of hearts they probably agree, although everybody's ego appreciates, especially after the hard work of producing a book, I think everybody would love to have that recognition. So, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of expectation setting that has to go along with any discussion of wanting to hit a bestsellers list, because not only – does it, it absolutely is no indicator of future performance. I've seen books hit the list and fall right off, and I think other times people think that the book hitting the list is a publicity event, that, you know, oh, well, that in and of itself is going to beget all of this media attention. No, not at all. Nobody cares. So, you know, it might matter in the speaking world, again, to help maybe with fees to differentiate you from some of your competitors. But on the retail side, it is not a game changer like some people think it is. You know, it doesn't necessarily widen or guarantee distribution. That is coming from the publicity and ongoing demand that you need to be generating through, like you said, the ongoing efforts to convey what the value is of the book and be within a community where you're participating.
So let me play devil's advocate again, because that's something that I
sure.
Yeah, well, I've been married for almost 11 years, so it's self-defense.
You understand that role.
is it worth it to go after New York Times best-selling strategy? Like you said, it takes some luck, it takes some science, it takes a lot of hard work, and like you said, it doesn't necessarily pay off.
Yeah. You know, it really depends on the person. I think if – I can speak for myself. If I were looking at what it takes to hit that list and, frankly – let's assume I'm also running a business, which is what most of these authors are doing. I frankly don't know how they do it without their heads spinning right off their bodies. I mean, it's just, it's a huge, huge, huge commitment. And I personally agree with you that and I've seen it with authors on my own list where they've not hit any list ever, but their book is, you know, a steady performer over time because the content is good and they're out there hustling day to day. And they've just made that a part of their practice, and it pays off in spades over time. So that is sort of the really long tail approach that I think works best in terms of serving the book and the business. But I've had some people who point blank have said, I know it's an ego thing, but for me, I've dreamed about this for years. This is what I need to feel like my book was successful. This is what I need to get this off my bucket list. And okay, if that's what it takes to make you happy, let's give it a go.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But you know, I can, you know, Tanya, honestly, if I had the money, I'd want to be able to brag that I was a New York Times bestselling author.
Sure, it would feel good.
And yeah, I can't blame them at all. So, you know, let me ask another question, get your take on this. So there have been a couple of authors that I've worked with, and they had sold 25,000 or 35,000, 50,000 books. They didn't make any best-selling lists, but I mean, Tanya, in my book, if you've sold 25,000 or 50,000 copies of a book, I think that it's a best-selling book. But whenever I've tried to get them to use that in their sales copy or in marketing, they always push back because they say, well, I've never made any kind of best-selling list. I tell them that most I work almost exclusively with business authors. And so I tell them that most business books don't sell, you know, even 500 copies. So if you sell 5,000 copies, most publishers, by most standards, a book that sells 5,000 copies is a decent performing book. Now, if you sell, again, 25,000 to 50,000, you are in the top, you know, 10% of your graduating class. And I think that you've got bragging rights. But I've never put the question to a publisher. So, A, how do you feel about that? And B, if you saw an author who said they were a best-selling author, would you feel that they were being deceitful or lying if you found out that they had never actually made a list, even a list of a smaller newspaper or a different newspaper, not just New York Times has a best-selling list, but you've got the Wall Street Journal, the the LA Times and a couple of others?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I see that all the time. As you might imagine, a lot of the books that come into us for review, the authors will either indicate in their materials that it's a best-selling book, or it'll be, you know, in a starburst right there on the cover. So I think it depends, first of all, on your audience. If this, and I believe that people should be transparent. So if you are saying it's a bestseller, I believe you should say what kind of bestseller it is. You know, it's an Amazon bestseller. It's an international bestseller, because there are some books that either maybe you hit a list in another country. it's a bestseller, not in the United States. Okay, it's an international bestseller. There are some folks who, we have a few titles that only hit the Wall Street Journal ebook bestsellers list, which is fascinating. So there's a separate list just for ebooks, and with the right promotional approach, you can just similar to, actually, it's much easier to do on the ebook side, because you're not hustling physical copies of a book that have to be in a certain place on a certain date. So there are ebook marketing strategies that can push a book up onto that list, and then you're a Wall Street Journal ebook bestseller. So I think people should be transparent about it. And the reason I say that the audience matters is that a publishing person will always hear that skeptically, because simply because we hear it so often, and quite often there is no substance behind the claim. So there's a tool, of course, that you'll know, that is BookScan. Nielsen operates it. The same folks who do SoundScan, and they do most of the metrics that help the media industries measure.
Yeah, the Nielsen rating.
Yeah, so BookScan is the primary tool that we have to actually understand the sell-through rate of books in the retail channels. Sadly, we get very little of that data from our retail partners. So that's how we can tell which books are actually moving, and that's how we can research titles to understand how something has performed in the marketplace to date. So if a book comes into us that's already been out in the world and someone says it's a bestseller, then the first thing we do is pull it up on BookScan. And I can't tell you how many times we see that it's sold, you know, 200 copies. So that, you know, that brings it down a notch in our eyes, because the author, it just does feel like it's rather deceitful. They're not being fully transparent about what that means.
Well, they're either deceitful or they're just ignorant.
It feels either like one. They're naive, you know.
either one is not a good
not a
market.
Plus.
Their corner.
Not a plus.
So in the very least, though, you're saying that if you're going to say bestseller status, that it needs to be third-party validation. So
yes.
Bestseller in this category, or bestseller according to this list. So even if they're an independently published author, and even if they sell 25 or 30 or 50,000 copies, it still needs to be, that bestseller status still needs to come from some kind of external validator.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that.
That's fair. You know what? Whenever you were first coming on, you were talking about whenever you were at the and Extra. You're saying that you had that people had pitched books to you. Talk a little bit about being the rookie, looking at those books, and you hadn't had at that point any real formal training or maybe mentoring in which books to look for, which to weed out. What was it like having to go through those decisions and making those decisions, especially as the newcomer? And is that, I guess what I'm kind of digging for is what kind of lessons that some authors can take away whenever they're pitching books to different places. So maybe not a publishing professional like a literary agent or a small house publisher, but if they're pitching books to these different places that are kind of niche or different gatekeepers, what should they be looking for? What kind of lessons can you give them from your days in vetting books to pass on?
Sure. So At both Extra and E, very, very celebrity-driven programming. So for me, it was really quite simple. Is this person a household name? That's what I was looking for. And I could make a decision in 2 seconds based on that. And I felt bad. I would get these packages, and our authors still send them out as well. You know, you get these very well thought out cover letters and a whole nice little promotional thing, and the decision is made in a split second. But they have to. The volume of submissions, you know, of stuff that they have to sort through is so high. And of course, they are the experts in audience that they're serving. So on the television side, they're looking. It's not unlike that, really, at any morning show, let's say. They're really driven, I would say, primarily by who's the author and why should we listen to you, why should we care, and then, of course, what's the message. So if an author is already established and known, then that's much, much easier, of course, to book versus, and it's not out of the question that somebody who's not known can get booked, but then you've got to really focus on what is really, really interesting about this message that hasn't been said and perhaps is a little controversial, that's what helps ratings. So I think people need to understand that when you're developing your pitch, it's smart to have, I would say, at least 4 or 5, because you're going to be dealing with different types of channels depending on whether they're personality-driven or story-driven. Sometimes you have more of a local angle, so different angles work for different channels. What else? I think if this is important, actually, for business book authors, actionable content is something that's a drum that I just beat constantly. I hear a lot of griping from readers when cocktail party conversations. You know, oh, I work in publishing. Oh gosh, books are so long. You just, like, I just don't want to read all this fluff. So, you know, especially in the business sector, they're busy. I get it. So people want actionable content that they can apply. And if somebody who's pitching to media says, here's a challenge that your audience has, they're struggling to, let's say, manage their personal finances, I help them do that by A, B, and C. And it's something new, ideally. Okay, that's an interesting story that gives people something to act on. They can actually create value, solve a problem, fill a need. That's a compelling hook. The other thing that I learned from actually being the person who pitched books for years at Greenleaf, I started the distribution program here. I built that department, built that team, hired all the reps. So that's my background in the company, and I know it like the back of my hand. And I've sat across from buyers and pitched them. And it was not unlike, you know, being on the other end of the table from when I worked in television, because it's a split-second pitch, and their eyes are glazed over, and you're just like, okay, what am I going to say to make them sit up a little bit straighter and pay attention? And sometimes you have to take two known things and use those to convey what this new thing is. So you might say, okay, this is Harry Potter meets James Bond. Oh, okay, so and now instead of me going through like 10 minutes of, well, okay, you see there's a wizard and he lives in this castle and then there's a spy. If you can take these two known things and combine them and pique their interest and then go from there, I've found that that's very effective, especially in the publishing world where they have access to a lot of different types of content and they know what their strong sellers are. So we'll try to kind of connect, you know, what we know that they'll react to and make a case for something new that way.
That reminds me of, and I imagine you probably picked that trick up from your days in Hollywood, but one of my favorite pitches was whenever they were pitching Alien with Sigourney Weaver back in, when did Alien come out? 84 or something? They said, it's pitching it to the producers or whoever, they said it's Jaws in space.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah, and that's everything. That's the whole...
You get it, right?
Jaws in space, yeah.
Yeah, that's very, very true.
Well, Tanya, let me ask you the three standard questions I try to ask everyone who comes on. So first, what is one of your favorite business books of all time?
Favorite business book of all time? It's a very hard question for me because there are so many on our own list that I absolutely adore, and I certainly don't want to upset any of my own authors by not.
Okay. So let me be fair. So taking out your own authors, which could be, I'm sure you're a bit biased. So taking out your own authors, a non-Greenleaf author, what's one of your favorite business books of all time?
Well, you know what? I'm actually going to – I'll jump back in to I'll make my own deathbed here and pick one of my authors because wrong case for it. One of my favorite business books is a book that we published, and it's Positive Intelligence by Shirzad Shamim. This book actually did hit the New York Times bestsellers list, and it also has enjoyed ongoing sales since then. So it's one of my favorites for that reason, of course. But also content-wise, this is one of those books that I'm always referring people to, and I think that's always a great indicator when you're speaking with somebody and the first thing that comes to your mind is like, oh, I've got the perfect book for you, and it so often it's this one because he kind of gets into some areas that I've always been fascinated by that deal with neuroscience and kind of the makeup of the human brain and why we think the way we think, and in particular why we often have some self-sabotaging thoughts or behaviors that we all have to kind of work through with the little devil and angel on our shoulders. And I'm also just a lifelong learner and a big believer in constantly improving and growing self-awareness. And this book has a strong emphasis on that as well. I wish I'd read it 20 years ago. I'm a completely different person now than I was then, and a lot of it has to do with really understanding attitude and self-awareness, and this book applies that in a business setting and with a special emphasis on working with teams. So as a, in management and leadership, obviously that's critically important. So it's a very accessible book in terms of how it's written. Beautifully done. It's quick. You can put it to work right away. And the folks that I refer the book to always respond to say, thank you. This book was fantastic. I'm so glad you told me to read it. So that one is definitely the first book that came to mind.
I hadn't come across that one before. I
send you a copy. It's great.
Oh, thank you. I would appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, so that's one of your favorite books of all time. So here's another question, tweaked a little bit. What's a great business book you've read recently?
So recently, I'm someone who jumps between books, which is a terrible habit.
I'm the same way. I've got 6 or 7 or 8 going at any time. You know what my problem is? I can't keep enough bookmarks around. Pick up, oh, this is interesting. Put a bookmark in that one. Oh, I forgot to finish that one. Go back to it.
Funny.
It's a reader's
literacy
problems,
yeah. well, one that I started and then I put it down, and it literally, I forgot about it because it kind of got pushed under my bed. And then I found it again. I was like, oh, yes, I do want to finish this book. it's terrible. But I'm glad I picked it up again because quite literally picked it up again, yes. I don't know how it got so far under the bed. But this book, it's Onward by Howard Schultz, and it's about Starbucks. And
yeah, Starbucks.
And he had previously written a book that was more about Starbucks' boom phase and their amazing growth and, rosy, everything's great. And that's fine, but I'm always so much more interested in reading about when things went wrong and what, the challenges people face, their problems, and then what they learned from it and how they changed. So that's what this book is about, and I think it's absolutely fascinating sort of counterpoint to his first book. So Onward really talks about the phase in which Starbucks grew too fast, and they lost a lot of the control over the operations side of the business. They were losing control over their quality and therefore their brand. So business was suffering, and as a business person myself, it's also just a fascinating read because you get it, and you read, oh my gosh, they couldn't even get beans to this location. very, very interesting. And he had a whole culture to rebuild. And that company is, you know, he's huge on culture. So just fascinating to understand all the trials and tribulations that he had to deal with, the people situations. You know, he had to make some difficult changes from his standpoint, and then how he had to re-energize not only his people, but that entire brand. Really well written, moves along at a great pace, and fascinating to read about because it's something that, you know, we all experience every day. Starbucks is sitting right on my desk. All the time.
Yeah, I'm a coffeeholic myself. Yeah, in fact, I found a meme the other day. I reposted on Facebook. It said, my blood type is coffee.
I love that. True. Same.
Third and last question. What is a book in any genre that everyone listening should read?
So when people ask me what book they absolutely should read, it's like, what's the one book you take to the proverbial desert island?
Yeah.
I know it's a little cliched, but my answer is How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And I really believe everybody should read that book. As somebody who is in publishing and I'm an avid reader of self-improvement, absolutely no qualms. That book rises all the way to the top. And it's also really interesting. It's something that I reread from time to time. And, you know, I think it was written in 1920. But a lot of his initial commentary in the book is dealing with the politics of the time, and you realize really quickly, like, nothing's changed. You know, you can switch out the names, but really nothing's changed. It's just fascinating. But the cardinal rules that he lays out in that book are just driving how you conduct yourself with other human beings, you know, to be a decent person and to feel good about yourself and be a positive influence on those around you. I really believe that everybody should try to incorporate those into their life because it's a game changer. So I'm a big advocate of that book.
Yeah, you know, how does the saying go? A classic is a book that everyone recommends but no one ever reads. But this book is different. You're right. It's one of those where it's not just that it's been around forever, and so it's the, you know, it's maybe one of the few business books that people have read, but it's one of those books that you keep going back to because there are timeless pieces of advice in there, and he's so positive. Whenever you're reading the book, you can't help but feel better. Wow, yeah, this is doable. I can do this.
You're right. It's the voice that it's written in. It's just, I want him to be my grandpa.
Yeah, it is. And that's, well, I mean, that's Dale Carnegie, right?
Yep. Yeah.
He was a legend.
For good reason.
Well, Tanya, before I let you get back to the business of running Greenleaf, is there anything that you'd like to leave us with? Anything you'd like to say to the people out there who are either supporting business authors or who are business authors or who want to be business authors?
I would say above all, and in the spirit of Mr. Carnegie, if there's any way I can help, I'm always happy to. Even if it means I refer you to someone else, that's totally fine. So I'm completely comfortable if it's all right with you, Derek, giving out my email address.
Absolutely.
If he wants to reach out to me. So, okay, it's just Tanya, T-A-N-Y-A, at greenleafbookgroup.com. Or on Twitter, I'm at Tanya Hall, T-A-N-Y-A-H-A-L-L. And, yeah, absolutely happy to connect, happy to help, happy to refer. A small industry, and we all try to help each other out. So also a big supporter of just helping people bring their ideas into the world. I think it's a very honorable thing to do. So, again, happy to lend a hand however I may. And then our website, if anyone needs more info on us or what we do, is www.greenleafbookgroup.com.
All right, Tanya. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
My pleasure.